Welcome to the new revolution in fitness and performance. The Ardella Training Podcast. Forging athletic bodies around the world. Here's your host, physical therapist and strength coach, Scott Ardella.
Hey, if you're looking for a new high-quality kettlebell, I've got a recommendation for you. My preferred kettlebell brand, due to the exceptional quality and outstanding price, is the Rogue Kettlebell, which I personally use. I recommend this brand if you're looking to add kettlebells to your collection or get started with your kettlebell training experience. The shape, the feel, and the quality is outstanding, and I highly recommend it. To see the exact kettlebell I use, go to ardellatraining.com/kettlebell. That's ardellatraining.com/kettlebell. You won't find a high quality kettlebell for this price anywhere else, so definitely check it out. All right, guys, welcome to episode number 117. And in this week's session, I have Dr. Ed Thomas. Now, Dr. Thomas is the guy that Gray Cook, Brett Jones, and so many others look up to, because he's paved the way for where things are in physical performance training. He's just a wealth of knowledge. He's got an extensive background and training history. You're going to hear all about that in just a minute. And just keep in mind that this interview is literally a snapshot of the insight and wisdom from Dr. Ed Thomas. And this is also an exclusive interview. You won't find any other podcast interview sessions with Dr. Thomas, because he rarely does this kind of stuff. And I'm really honored, really grateful that he decided to come on this show and share just a little bit of insight with his extensive training background. And again, you're going to hear all about that in just a minute. Before we get into the interview, I do want to share the winners for the Rogue gift card. First of all, thank you so much. If you're one of the people who left a review in iTunes or Stitcher, the reviews over the past couple weeks have been really, really fantastic. And as I've mentioned, they really help to grow the show and what I'm trying to do here with the podcast. So thank you so much. I wish that I could give gift cards to everyone who left a review, but I'm not able to do that, of course. But I do have some winners here. So the winners are, and I do apologize if I mispronounce anyone's names. So the winners are Paul Coriel, Addison Marshall, Dwayne Lawrence, and I did select a fourth winner. I mentioned I was only going to pick three. Well, I picked one extra just for the heck of it. So Ashley Cole is the fourth winner. So these people were randomly selected. Literally, names were picked out of a hat, and these are the names I came up with. So congratulations, guys. Make sure that we connect in the next couple of days, and I'll get you the $50 gift card for Rogue Fitness. I'll be reaching out to you guys, and if for some reason I don't have your contact information, if you don't hear from me in the next couple of days, make sure that you contact me through the ardellatraining.com website. Again, thank you so much. So back to this week's session. I have Dr. Ed Thomas. Now, I could be here for an hour reading through his extensive resume and credentials, and I should just tell you that he is considered one of the leading experts in the area of physical training, and specifically in the area of Indian clubs. But he really is a training expert in many different areas, although he doesn't consider himself an expert. Now, my suggestion for this show is to listen through this show more than once to really understand it, because some of the concepts are pretty high level, and you'll need to hear them a couple of times for them to really sink in and understand what he's talking about. And again, this is a guy that has decades of training experience, and he's still so involved in physical training today. You're going to hear about his unconventional training methods, what he's up to right now, and why he thinks this is actually the future. So let me share with you Dr. Thomas's experience and background through decades of training. He is an author, presenter, lecturer, and renowned expert. He has extensive training and teaching experiences at the university level, including Graceland University, Troy State University, Emory University, and others. He has extensive training experiences in the U.S. military, including the United States Army, and he is considered a physical readiness training pioneer. He's a Fulbright scholar, and Jeremy Levin, the head physical training advisor to the U.S. Navy SEALs, calls Dr. Thomas a world-class physical educator. He says that he is a gifted teacher who recognized many years ago the power of training concepts that are cutting edge today. Again, I could spend a lot of time going through Dr. Thomas's extensive resume and experiences, and you'll hear directly from Dr. Thomas about his training experiences and background as well. I do want to let you know that before we get into this, that the audio quality is not the best, unfortunately. It is what it is, but for this session, we were not able to do an interview over Skype, and the audio is not the absolute best. So I just wanted to be upfront about that. Keep in mind that the content is what's most important. And as I said this before, I would recommend listening to this more than once. Also, keep in mind that this interview is literally just the tip of the iceberg as far as what Dr. Thomas knows. It's only a sample of his wisdom and insight. It's impossible to cover decades of training knowledge in just a one-hour interview, so please keep that in mind as well. And with that, let's dive into the interview and get started with a really unique, really innovative, cutting-edge interview session with Dr. Ed Thomas. Enjoy. All right, everybody. Today, I am very honored and very excited to bring you an exclusive interview with Dr. Ed Thomas. We were just talking, and you were telling me that you don't do a lot of interviews. So I really, really thank you for doing that, for doing the interview, taking the time. And I think it's going to be really a valuable discussion for listeners. So really, really thank you for doing this. And I know that you have a huge, long, extensive history in physical training. But I wonder if you can give listeners just a snapshot of your background, your history, and maybe what you've done in recent years.
Recent years. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'll hit 70 in a couple of months. So yeah, I've been on a lot of trails, Scott. But recently, I dropped out. I quit all my jobs last September. So I just train and study all day. It's endless summer for you old people out there. Remember that? I think you still call it that. Getting up with no one to complain to you about what you're not doing. But I just train and study now, but I've been at it a long time now.
Can you talk about your training right now? So you say that you train and study all the time. What is your training? What is a typical day of training for you right now?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think it goes back to an ethos of my generation. I'm not really a baby boomer. I was born when Hiroshima and Nagasaki were still smoldering. So I think it's something that I just picked up from that other generation. And I was a soldier many years ago, and I started practicing judo in about 1960 and grew up as a wrestler and a gymnast over in Davenport in the old German gymnastics. So it was kind of an ethos that if I wasn't on a mission, I was training for the mission. And I mean, I don't ever remember a time when I was a kid and I wasn't thinking that way. I wanted to be a knight first, and then I decided that wasn't work, so I became Robin Hood, and that didn't work either. But I've always trained. So, but the training changes over the years. I mean, just like your training and everyone's training, it changes.
Yes.
But there's always been some of the same stuff that has stayed, you know, and then you jettison some of the other training. Well, most recently, and I don't mind giving my YouTube channel. It's not widely known, but I'll give it to your listeners. It's Via Militaris, one word, V as in Victor, IAMILITARIS, Via Militaris. And for the last 6 months, I spent at least 2-3 hours a day on remembering a system of training that I did as a little boy. You want to hear that story?
Yes.
Absolutely. People have a lot of freaking stories, don't they? So, yeah, so, and who can make this up? And, you know, there's a lot of talk about breathing these days.
Absolutely.
And breath, and, you know, and how the how something in, inside, behind the sternum, whether, you know, if I'm in, if I'm here in the West and, I say, what the hell is going on? I can't move, you know. Well, you go around and between the shoulder blades, your T-spine's locked up. And then I go live in another country and the little guy comes around and kind of smiles and says, oh, your chakra. And so there's something in there that was locked up, and breath seems to be the way to unlock it. So yeah, breath is the key. And so when I was a little kid, I learned to use this thing called a harp or a harmonica. He called them harp. And he was what they call a hobo, and he lived down along the Mississippi River. They'd stay there in the summer. He's across the river from the Rock Island Line, so these tons of hobos were always there. And I was running home from the natatorium, this big swimming pool, one day along the river, and I heard this amazing sound coming out of the dump. And there was this guy, I found him, and he was lying on his back, and he had this little weight on his stomach, and he was making sounds I had never heard in my life. And I'll keep the story short, but eventually he taught me some things about how to use it, and then he disappeared. And but he said he would teach me that if I would never let anyone hear me play, and I agreed. And so, but before he disappeared, about 3 weeks later, before he disappeared, I said to him that was difficult, and someone no one to hear me. And he said, son, he looked at me, he says, you'll know when it's time. And in 1977, someone actually heard me play, so I quit playing, and I didn't pick it up. Till about a year and a half ago, when I began reading about COPD,
yes.
And breathing.
Yes.
And so I began putting back together that system that he taught me. And you'll see some of the clips now on Via Militaris. But I use foam rollers and kettlebells, and you'll see I use... but I've also included some of the techniques I learned from Dr. Robert N. Martin. You know who he is? The readers might know. He's the guy who invented the inversion boots.
Okay.
And who made the table popular. I was out at Gold's Gym in the summer in the 70s, and I would go out and steal ideas out there in Venice from the pros, because I was teaching weight training at the U of Iowa by accident because nobody wanted to teach it. And I saw Franco Colombo and Frank Zane on these boots.
Really?
And I was blown away. So I found out the guy who invented him was in Pasadena. His name was Robert M. Martin. He was an orthopedic MD over there. So I went to his clinic on Union Street, and it turned out he was from Iowa. And, oh, my God, what a moment that was, you know, because he was a genius. He'd been a chiropractor. He was a chiropractor, osteopath, and an MD, but he'd been a vaudeville gymnast, and he was a teacher in the German system that I had studied. And so we bonded, I think I can say, honestly. And for the next 20 years, I went to him and studied with him, went to his home and learned all I could about his training system. So, and then he became a recluse because he went bankrupt, you see, unfortunately. Back then, people, the medical community, the scientific community, everybody revolted against being head downward. They said, you know, the blood would rush to your head and, you know, all of that. And hanging from the legs was hard on the knees. Dr. Martin would say, oh, I suppose hanging from my arms is hard on my elbows. But anyway, he became a recluse, but I've included some of his stuff on the YouTube channel, too.
Yeah, so I will definitely attach a direct link to this channel in the show notes for this episode so that people can go and check it out. And you really have to see the videos and see the positioning and see what Dr. Thomas is talking about here. So I highly recommend... checking
yeah,
out that.
Pretty cool. In fact, keep an eye.
Yes.
Keep an eye on the. Yeah, just keep. I kind of zeroed in on some of the breathing so you can see what it looks like. But
yes.
Yeah, keep an eye on what's happening. It's just amazing.
What? So you said that you started this. You got back into this about a year ago. What have you noticed? What improvements or changes have you seen?
It's hard to say. I don't know what I would be if I wasn't me. But as you can see from the video,
yes.
If take a look at the one called Breathe, which I did a year ago, and you can see, in fact, I think I did a clip. I got into a muscle suit. This is creepy stuff. I never do this, but no one knew it was me.
Oh,
but
I
found
I see.
This muscle suit in China.
Yes.
From China, and I put it on at the Perform Better Summit, and I did some handstands and headstands, some static stuff. I just stay up for like 5 or 10 minutes, and with this muscle suit, it just was a really creepy look, I think. But it really demonstrated how beautiful the musculature was. But I'm 70 years old. I was thinking, I guess it's doing something.
Yeah, I see the video. I want to click it, but I know there'll be sound to it. And we're doing the interview here, but I will check that one out later for sure.
Now, let's put it this way: if we can unlock the breath, and just not that way, because it wasn't just the harp. I was also an accidental yoga teacher at the U of Iowa because I let my so I came out of the infantry in 1969. And to disappear at that time, soldiering wasn't such a particularly infantry wasn't such a great career choice. I let my hair grow out, and I found that people wouldn't talk to me as much if I looked like a hippie or whatever that was. And so I took that look, and when I went to the U of Iowa then in the fall, and I took a judo class, and I had a rank in judo, so the teacher said, hey, why don't you teach it? And within a year, I said, hey, teach yoga. I couldn't even spell it. But, it took me on that journey then to find out what yoga is. You know, there's a little bit of it in martial arts, some of the breathing and the posture and all, but to actually immerse myself in this, I think I was gone for 2 years the first time. I went to all over the United States chasing yogis back in the 70s, and then I ended up living in Burma and Thailand and Korea for 2 years and Germany, but always looking for teachers who could help me understand what this yoga stuff was.
Right. So through all your years of training experience, I mean, where do you consider yourself an expert in, a specialist in terms of human movement?
We were generalists back then, Scott. I think I listened to Brett's interview, and it's really true. For me to call myself a specialist is to somehow say that I really earned, when I remember my teachers, I haven't gotten to their level yet. So it's hard for me to call myself a specialist in anything. I'm a student.
Yeah.
I'm as interested in what you have to say as I am in what I have to say. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. And again, I have not been training for the years you have. I have been training for a long time, but I feel the same way. I mean, I am a student and always will be because there's just too much to learn about the human body. And
I'll tell this to your listeners too, honestly, when I think back about what was available to me in terms of knowledge, and in the mainstream today, light years ahead, and that I think we mentioned earlier in our earlier conversation offline was that 1989 was a real tipping point when the Berlin Wall went down. And the Soviet Union went through its upheaval. Some of that old world physical training began to come out. And the same thing in Asia, as the anti-Asian sentiment from World War II began to wane, there's rich knowledge that's in Asia that is still yet to be tapped. Amazing stuff. So, it'd be nice to be your age again and still be immersed in all of that.
So we actually did talk about the 1980s, and there were some really bad things going on in the fitness industry in the 80s. What were some of the good things? What were some of the learning experiences or gold nuggets we can take out of the 1980s?
Well, here's a neat way to see it. Look at it across time, and let's take a look at it through the lens of a fellow by the name of Thomas Cureton. And Thomas Cureton was a professor over at U of Illinois. In the PE field, he's known as the father of physical fitness. Others argue that it was other people, but Cureton was really good at helping us understand the paradigm of all of this. And he said that you measure fitness in three ways. He said he called it physique, organic function, and motion. Isn't that brilliant? And well, if you look back at the 60s and look how we were defining fitness, it was mostly physique, a lot of bodybuilding back then. And then the 80s. Ken Cooper, came along with the emphasis on the heart. And while Cureton's definition was broader, freedom from disease and circulatory, respiratory, endocrine, all of that, that period in the 80s was a focus on running and what was called aerobics back then. And the functional then history began with more of an emphasis on motor capacity. Well, in truth, all three are important. physique, organic function, and motion. They're all important. And that's where you guys are taking the definition, which is pretty cool.
Now, do you think that the in today's world that motion is becoming, is it coming back? Or
That's exactly what happened, you know, when, I mean, but you look at Vern Gambetta does a great definition of functional fitness, if you go to his website.
Yes.
And I think the first one is posture and dynamic balance. That becomes a really important idea, which you guys are really blowing through the roof, and it's just a wonderful thing to be watching. And here's what I mean by that. When once you decided that posture was important again, we began to look at the body. When we began to look at the body, we began to discuss physique again. You know, what's physique? Alignment, proportion, symmetry. All of that's becoming a part of the discussion again, which is really amazing, I think. We never had that discussion before.
I wanted to ask you this question, and this is a question I asked a recent guest. And the question is, how would you define being fit? Is there such a thing?
Well, I think Cureton nailed it. Physique, organic, function, and motion.
Okay, it's a combination of all three.
What he really said was, that's how you measure it.
Yes.
And that takes us down a really interesting trail, because for the future of the field right now, measurement, test and measurement is the key. Now, test and measurement was spiked back during World War II because we did a lot of it. You know, and the results were sobering, but there are some amazing books. And I remember in test and measurement classes that we took, of course, for exercise science, they were laborious because we had to do all the calculation by hand. Excel does all the work now. Whoever goes out and grabs up some of these really good test and measurement books is going to blow the roof off of the field one of these days.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I'll give you a couple names of some of the books. Would that be helpful?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think if you start with Charles McCloy, he and Norma Young wrote one, and I believe it's called Test and Measurement in Health and Physical Education. McCloy was one of the architects of the World War II physical training. And there's any of the old PT manuals are good, too. The women's PT are FM3520 and FM2120, But I'll tell you another book, like The Gold Standard, and it's relatively new. It's by Ronald Kirby. It's really hard to find. It's called Kirby's Guide to Fitness and Motor Performance Tests. A ton of professionals grabbed all the tests they could find that had some reliability and objectivity, and they assessed them. And they put them into categories like muscular endurance and flexibility and whatever. It's like a Bible of all these cool tests. Pretty neat book.
Right. So it's hard to find?
Yeah.
Yeah. You
know, all the good stuff is.
Yeah. Right.
You know why? But once again, nobody was interested. Here's Kirby. He makes this amazing effort to put it all together. He probably didn't sell many books because nobody... Test and measurements, if you go to any physical education class in the country, test and measurements are awful, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, fitness grams and all that redundant nonsense. But once again, we found there's a tipping point, and you see more and more physical educators out there who said, enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
In fact, have you seen the stuff now on the La Sierra program that's just been published? Are you familiar with that?
No.
La Sierra High School was the gold standard of physical education programs in 1962. Pathé News did a great piece on it. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
It's black and white. If you go online, look up La Sierra High School, 1962. It'll blow your mind. You'll see. See, back, and by the way, there's another great book if your readers want to look up JFK's Secret Doctor. That's a relatively new book. His name was Hans Krauss. He and Bonnie Pruden, who was another pioneer. You want to hear the Hans Krauss story?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. Hans Krauss was an orthopedic MD that arrived in 1938 out of Austria. He became a very famous mountain climber. You'll read in his book that he did with very little equipment what people today have trouble doing. And he and Bonnie Pruden then were climbing partners. But in 1938, when he arrived, he noticed that he said Americans didn't move very gracefully. Now, he's looking at the European model, the old European model. So he starts thinking of backache. He opens up a clinic, and he realizes, oh, my God, backache's epidemic. This is 1938 in the United States. So they don't move well. I believe the term back then was parakinesia.
Okay.
And they have back problems. Well, eventually, he creates this test, which became a predictor, they thought, of back problems. They thought it might become a predictor. It was called the Krauss-Weber test. And it was given to about 5,000 kids, 6 to 18 or something like that. And about 60% of the kids failed. And as they were mountain climbers traveling the world, they tested them in Europe, and only about 9% failed. And the test was real so easy the Japanese couldn't take it. And this is 1950s, and we just come out of two wars. So when Eisenhower got hold of this study, he was alarmed, and that eventually became the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sport. Well, the physical educators were having none of it, and they wanted to do sports and games, and so he was called a communist and a troublemaker. And I got to talk to him numerous times before he passed away, and he said they just outlasted him. And then when Kennedy was assassinated, the whole movement fell apart again. But see, he became Kennedy's back doctor.
Right.
Some will say he brought Kennedy back to life through he used things now that we're just rediscovering. And anyway, long story. I forget where it'll go, but the La Sierra program. So the La Sierra program was, he hires Bud Wilkinson to be the head of the President's Council because Wilkinson believed in weight training as much as football.
Okay.
And then guys like Bob Hoffman, you ever heard of him?
Yeah, sure.
York Bud, he was writing Strength and Health. See, people don't know, Hoffman was a World War I combat vet, and if they want to read a book that will roll their toes, get his book called I Remember the Last War, where he writes about the importance of fitness during World War I. Amazing book. And Hoffman, then, he's featuring, like, in the 60s, once every issue he features a university or college that has a weight training program. This is all propaganda to get the coaches interested in lifting weights and fitness again. So this is a struggle in the 60s. So when you see the 80s, I mean, it was a struggle, 60s, 80s. I mean, it's just been a struggle for us to figure out, how to train our bodies.
So do you think today, I mean, are things headed in the right direction in the industry? And what do you think that we can do better?
I think the interest in history is really healthy. I think if we can spend a little bit more time looking at how we got here, I think it's going to be a lot easier to figure out where we need to go. And some of that's going to exist. And thank God for the internet and the access to this stuff. But history holds a lot. In fact, we'll go one more time if you want back to the La Sierra program because that's future stuff. See.
Yeah.
When the La Sierra program started to fold up, Kennedy was assassinated in 63, and there were other reasons, but it was only a spike on the radar, but artifacts remained, and they were all rediscovered about a year ago, and these are color 16-millimeter film. If you go online and look it up, you'll see there's an effort now to make it into some kind of a documentary, because what it's going to show you, Here's what Stan Laprati, he set up the program. Here's what he got, because he was, I think he'd been a Marine. What they learned, what they remembered in World War II was something about socially facilitated exercise. Social facilitation was a concept that we used as kids during the Turnverein. It was also used, it was a psychological concept that means basically this. Under certain conditions, a large group of people can learn to do something much better than one or two people alone. Under other conditions, their learning will be impaired. If we can figure out those conditions under which that learning occurs, we can transform large groups physically very quickly using the right progression, the variety, and the precision. But group training is... See, group, and this is interesting because you remember years in the 80s, it was just put on the bun warmers and dance. Oh, my God, 20 years later, I got this new hip.
Yeah.
But now you expect to learn something when you go to the gym,
right? Right.
And the ones that aren't going down that road are, they're having problems, trying to fit in this new paradigm. Well, I don't know why I'm telling you that. Like I say, I get bored talking about this stuff. I'd rather go train, but. But the fact is, social facilitation. Okay, so in other words, there is a way of teaching lots of people to do something really, really well. And so today, that thing called group exercise or what we just call mass training is becoming more and more discussed.
Yes.
How does that work? Well, there's even another level. which is what they figured out years ago, and said, it's not enough for me. Like, if not enough for me as an instructor to get up on the platform and teach 50 people how to transform themselves, it's more important than any one of those 50 should be able to come up on the platform and teach it themselves to others. So it's the Latin is docendi decimus, I think it means by teaching I learn.
Okay.
So the older paradigm was for, let's say, if you have someone out there that works in a gym somewhere, it's for them. It's like the Taekwondo or the martial arts idea. You know, you're training them to be instructors. You're not teaching them to be just to be fit.
Right. So talking about all the history here, so where did all this start? Like, when the early days, I've seen videos of you talking about the historical perspective of strength training and barbells, kettlebells, Indian clubs. What can you tell us about the early days of physical training?
Well, you mean early days in antiquity, like the ancients, or in the early days, you know, for some people, the 80s are the early days, and for others, Sparta is the early days.
Yeah, I mean the old days, yeah, the Sparta days.
So the Athenian. Well,
yes.
I think, you know, historians might disagree, but I tend to know more about the Athenian model than the Spartan, but mainly just because I lean more toward the Athenian model, which was, which was an equal emphasis on the philosophical, you know, the purpose of life itself, Yeah, we usually go to Athens for that, and there are clues to what was done, and then we can also go to the Renaissance. Mercurialis, De Arte Gymnastica is a good reference if you want to take a look at what it looked like. But and then the golden era in the United States for physical training was about 1885 to 1920. The lights went out by about 1920, but that doesn't mean there weren't stars in the sky. Like, for instance, if any of your listeners can ever get a hold of Body Molding, it's eight little magazines by Alan Calvert, a game changer. If you can't do that, then go to YouTube and take a look at Otto Arco. You ever heard of him? It'll blow your mind. Right? Yeah. Now, in the 1930s, these Arco, they were all influenced by Edmund Checkley. And you can believe that guys like Grimmick and all these old timers, that Schwarzenegger and Dan Kuhn, those guys, all those guys, you know, looked up to. See, they're all going back and reading these. You know, they all had these inspirations. Well, Checkley, he wrote one called A Natural Method of Physical Training. But the reason I say Calvert's book on body molding, if you go in there right away, it talks about breathing, it talks about posture, it talks about being aware of the body, all the stuff you guys are starting to talk about now.
Yeah, some of these old books, and I have one of the Alan Calvert books, and I can't reach the book right now, it's sitting across, but excellent book. And, you know, again, a lot of these old books that have been republished are just outstanding.
You know, we should never forget that just beyond the veil here, these lives were as rich as we could imagine, some of them, and all of it was compacted into a book. You know?
Yeah.
Amazing. The other thing for your readers is to get any of the old gymnastics catalogs, like Medart and Narragansett. Oh, there, you know, if you're looking for ideas, because what they're going to give you in 04, I think it was 04, I did the keynote for Funda, I think it was to predict the future.
Okay.
And one of them was, at that time, off the ground training hadn't been rediscovered yet. You know, so I said, off the ground training, of course, once we start looking at the history, well, there are a lot of off the ground training that hasn't yet been done, and you can see what it is by looking at the equipment.
What are the videos that I've seen that are on the On Target website or Greg Hook's website? It's a 4-part video series of you giving a lecture about the history of strength training. Where were those videos?
Where was I at that time?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I did something for him down at Averitt. I think it was the 150th anniversary of something, and I went down to do something for their school.
Okay, that's a great 4-part video series. I just wanted to mention that. As well. What happened in 1920? So things fell off in 1920. What happened?
Yeah, it was called The Battle of the Systems. And, you know, once again, whole books are written about it, so I sure don't want to filter it through my limited mind. But basically, it was at one level a discussion in the country about how we would define our physical culture. And in the beginning, it was heavily fueled by a notion which now the historians call muscular Christianity. And there's a book, several books written by that title, but it goes something like this. And maybe we could see it better first by looking at the Romantic period in Germany of the early 1800s, when there's sort of a spiritual awakening that was fueled by a physical awakening in which the body was seen as a temple. Well, out in the East Coast in the mid to late 1800s, there was growing concern that boys were not growing up to be what they called manly. But manly didn't mean caricature manly. It meant to have nobility and, you know, and discipline and all of those uprightness. And they looked at them physically and said, you know, this is the problem. You know, the YMCAs came out of that, and so it was an attempt to redefine the human body as a temple and to treat it such. It was fueled by a philosophical movement. I think the philosopher Spencer said something about physical morality, that each of us has a moral imperative to take care of ourselves, and that eventually morphed into a spiritual imperative. And so that spiritual imperative then borrowed from these systems. Like, for instance, the Germans brought an amazing system over in 1840. They're called the 48ers. It was called the Turnverein. And it evolved out of the early 1800s in response to Napoleon's attack. But it was linked directly to the Renaissance and back to the Greeks and its application and its theory. And the Swedes brought a great system over in 1885. Nils Posse brought over earlier, but it stuck in 1885. And by the way, it heavily influenced, we can imagine, John F. Kennedy, because that was his neighborhood. You know, these Swedish gymnastics. When you see stall bars, you're looking at Swedish gymnastics. When you get a massage, you're often looking at Swedish massage. So this is an amazing system. Well, all these systems were competing for supremacy. The Czechs had a system. The French had a system. But the two big dogs were the Swedes and the Germans, and they were fighting it out because they had this new field called physical education. They wanted a piece of it. So in Davenport, for instance, Davenport, Iowa, was where the first bridge across the Mississippi was built, and so railroad bridge. So it happened in the 50s, early 1850s, so thousands of Germans came swarming in. They stopped right where they were. They were running from a revolution in Germany. Germany was in upheaval, so thousands of Germans were swarming in. Like, they'd stop in Cincinnati, and a lot of them would settle. They built a Turner Hall. There were Turner Halls all over the country. Well, these Turner Halls had these training halls in them, these physical training halls in them. Absolutely ingenious training halls. So I grew up in one of them, in Davenport, because Davenport then, when the Germans swarmed in, and there was this bridge, and so Davenport, Iowa, became the new frontier once that bridge was built. And as they came in, were heading west, then bang, a lot of them just settled, so it became this heavily populated German community. I had one of the best Turner Halls in the country.
Right. Now, is this medical gymnastics? I've heard you talk about that in the videos. Is that what this...
Medical gymnastics is, we try to define this stuff over time. And so if we go back and look, Swedish gymnastics heavily influenced that definition. But if you go back and look at Tissot, the French physician, I think it was 17th, 18th century, I forget, I said movement and effect can take the place of many remedies, but all the remedies together can never take the place of the effect of movement. And we got it. You know, movement under the right conditions can heal. But medical gymnastics as a concept was really pulled together probably conceptually by A.L. Lindfors and P.H. Ling. They were Swedish because they defined physical training as three categories, basically, medical, military, and pedagogical. That would be school-based.
Okay.
So I'll do them again, medical, military, and pedagogical. So they have to do with intent as well as technique. But let's say, for instance, as you define it that way, you take swimming. Well, swimming could be any one of those, because pedagogical would be sports, games, theoretical bodies of knowledge, dance. And
okay.
All the stuff you do in school. Then medical would be, in fact, I'll tell you a funny story. Back in the 80s, and there was this debate going on about who, you know, what was medical and what wasn't. See, because what happened was, in the 1920s, when we denounce these systems, I should go back to that. See, the Germans and the Swedes, everybody's fighting for the supremacy to get into the schools. In the end, we denounced all of them, and we chose sports and games as the dominant feature of our physical education in our country. Sports and games.
Right.
Very Darwinian, you know, who can win? Survival of the species, the survival of the fittest. So all those teachers began to die.
Well, let me go back and ask you about the medical gymnastics. So what are some specific examples of training? Like, for listeners today, how would we associate what is medical gymnastics? Is it push-ups? Is it Indian clubs?
Okay. I know I was going to tell you. Yeah. So, back then, I went over to I wanted to create a degree. This is the early 80s. I went to create a degree where we could redefine this stuff classically, including medical gymnastics. So I had to create a curriculum, and I had to find a school that let me do it. I couldn't find one in the States, so I went over to the DMZ of South Korea. We developed a two-year degree over there and this stuff. So I called it, I couldn't call it medical gymnastics.
Right.
So I found the medical degree, go nuts, you know. So because PE teachers aren't like, I would always say, look, if you feel better after this workout, don't blame me. I'll get sued. I can't heal you. Right? So don't. And if you have a problem, don't tell me. You know,
right.
I won't work with you. And it was that strict back then. It was these real fights going on over turf, because that goes back to when we took the sports. See, back in the 1920s, when PE took the sports, well, the ROTC took the military physical education, and the medical community, the physical therapists, took the medical gymnastics. All that was divided up. PT, physical education, only owned the sports, and that's sort of how the history unfolded. And now it's been, there's more of a blending of all of this than there ever was again.
So what type of movements are examples that are contained?
What I did was define what a restorative art. I couldn't call it medical gymnastics, so I found the term restorative exercise in an old manual,
right?
An old army manual. So I began using the word restorative exercise,
okay.
And you see a lot more in the literature these days, restorative exercise. But I started using that in the early 80s. But it was a little tricky at first, because restorative arts, as I called them, actually was mortuary science. It was making the dead look good. So I had to work that definition through. All this was Orwellian.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Orwellian stuff, because, they couldn't figure out, we couldn't figure out who owned what. So,
Right.
Yeah, so what makes it medical? It makes it medicinal if overall, when you're done moving, it's helped you. In other words, if physical activity, I can jump out a second-story window, it's physical activity.
Right.
So not all movement is equal. Not all sports are equal. Some sports make us lopsided. Some sports make us sick. You know? Some sports create symmetry. So, yeah, all movement isn't equal. That's for darn sure.
Switching gears just a little bit, I wanted to make sure that I did ask you this question, but is there a most important physical quality?
The balance between the physique and organic function and motion. And it doesn't matter where, or a circle even. You know, it doesn't really matter where, because physique, if I can change my physique to some degree, it should impact on my function. It should impact on my motion. If I can develop a better movement pattern, it will eventually impact on my physique and on my function. So, you know, we're down to that awful realization that every one of us is on this individual journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, every little decision we make, every thought we have, every deed we do, it's all added up inside the body.
I'll just share one thing about that in my own experience. So I used to be a bodybuilder when I started my journey, and I wasn't focused on function at all. And now that I am, I mean, the physique is there, but I really focus on the function and the movement and performance more than anything. And it just made a big difference in me. I guess it's really just been part of the journey, the process for me. But I really feel like in my early days, when I first started training, my function and performance was horrible. And it's because I really didn't focus on it. I was more of the bodybuilding mindset and, you know, using a lot of machines and things like that. And Certainly there's not.
Yeah, and you know, that's because that was, like we mentioned, that was the flow of knowledge as we, you know, as we unlock all of this. That I'll tell you something else though, for your listeners, which is really interesting. You know, you think about the battles yet to be fought in terms of structure. One of the most pernicious yet to be addressed issues is school furniture. For that, I would start them by looking up Daryl Boyd Harmon, H-A-R-M-O-N, Daryl Boyd Harmon. Back in the 1930s and 40s, he was out of Texas, put together this amazing group of people to look at the differences in desk angles and the impact they were having on learning and posture.
Right.
And so about 22 degrees is the ideal, I think, if I remember the literature. Our desks have been flat now for two generations. But what they didn't see, and now what we understand, is the hip angle also has to be different. Anybody at a 90-degree hip angle for any amount of time is going to suffer spinal damage, and we're doing it to our children. Here in Iowa, I estimated, because I was in charge of all of the health and PE and substance abuse prevention for the state for like 13 years. I did a 10-year anecdotal study. I saw about 90% of our kids were visibly deformed by second grade.
Wow.
So right away the brain's going on yellow because they're breathing through straws.
Yeah.
They're not even breathing under those conditions. They can't learn. So there's executive function is really impaired. They're on yellow. They're saying, help, help.
Yeah.
So, In fact, what we do as trainers is going to be more and more difficult. Each generation, we're getting worse. So we just never can quite get to the bipedal development under those conditions. It's what Dr. Martin used to call hyperflexion with rotation. And it's deforming, you know, soft tissue, bone, everything gets jacked up. But if you look on the website of Via Militaris, you'll see here in Iowa, we actually got pretty close. Our prison industries have now developed a desk with the optimal angle, and they're exploring, and they're the ones who sell they sell the furniture to our schools, and they're also using another tool that allows for the 60-degree hip angle.
Well, this is really important to know, actually, for the desk jockey, you know, the person that is sitting at a computer desk all day working in a sedentary occupation. I mean, you could say the same thing about that as well.
Oh my God, it's killing us, you know. We're bipedal. There was something in us that wanted to stand on our hind legs.
Yeah.
And once you lock those shoulders forward, you can't even, the head doesn't even turn. All those primitive safety instincts that try to make us aware of our environment are shut down because you can't even look, you can't even see. Yeah, it is. It's really sad. I tell you though, listeners look at this stuff, they realize that it's a tipping point moment. See, back in 19, if they look up on Google, I believe it's called Wasim. I think it's W-A-S-S-E-M or something like that, or two E's. It's called sitting. Wasim Bashir and his team of researchers did some. They did radiological research on this, and found out 60 degrees. And then acmandel.com would be a good place to start. Out of Copenhagen, Dr. A.C. Mandel, great article on hip angle and sitting. Just that one thing alone would change, would be a game changer for our cores, for everything, because you can't fix these kids when we've done this to them for 12 years.
Yeah.
And these are athletes. The only difference between the athlete and the regular folks is the athlete just took the punishment better.
Right. Dr. Thomas, before we started the interview here, we were talking a little bit about Indian clubs, and you said that it's about the journey with Indian clubs. Can you talk about what you mean with that statement?
Well, yeah, that's another one of those stories. You know, I started when I was about 8 years old, and they came to the States from Britain, but the Brits got them from India. They were an Olympic event in 04 and 32, but they were first found in the hands of the Vedic gods in about 5,000 years ago. But there also is this journey from Iran, Iraq, India. So there's some discussion about how they got to all of those. But what I mean by a journey is that something like that is a hell of a lot more than a warm-up. There's something there. You know, there's something in these circular patterns. And The training I learned as a boy wasn't quite the same as what I learned in Burma. I lived in Burma for 9 months in 88, and I had a teacher there, which was much closer to the to India. And so I think I had a whole different idea of how to use them, and I found it there. And then I had a Czechoslovakian teacher who showed me a Sokol, a gymnastic system called Sokol, who showed me his system. So I think the journey over time, I lived in Germany, I found teachers there. I lived in Korea, found teachers there. So I think the journey has been in the manifestations of how this stuff is used. And it's very powerful. You know, we talk a lot about crossing the center line and what that does for the brain and how. So for those who don't know what I'm talking about, the Indian club has a little ball that you hold onto. It has a little shaft and the weights on the end. So imagine if you're adding one more joint to this ball and socket sequence. And the weight out on the end then is creating this force. It pulls everything away from your center line and all these beautiful patterns. And if we're talking about unlocking T-spine and chakra, imagine all those little circular forces going on inside the center of the spine.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, we don't know what it's we don't know yet what it's for. What we do know is that a club is just a piece of junk unless it's used beautifully. And I think I mentioned to you offline is that I don't consider myself an expert in club swinging. The rest of them are all, they're all dead, you know. And the reason, see, no one cared about clubs. I mean, the reason I only trained quietly myself all these years because no one cared. If they'd see me, they just laugh at me.
Yeah.
And if I use a med ball, all this stuff I did for years, I just got laughed at until, but that was okay because then I didn't get bothered, which was great. So I could just train, but yeah, I think the club swinging is a journey because what you're really looking for is one perfect movement.
Yeah.
I used to work for the Army, and the guys would say, "How many push-ups should I do?" And I say, "Just one, just one. Just show me one perfect push-up. No, not that one. Look, your elbow rolled out a little bit. No, your middle finger's off target a little bit. No, one perfect push-up. That's all."
So with Indian clubs, it's really about precision movement. And quality.
Yeah, it's three things: progression, variety, and precision. So
okay.
it's staying within your basic progression level, and then a variety because there are an infinite number of. Some have said, you know, up to 400 times 10,000 patterns, because when you start doing footwork, it's infinite. The footwork looks a lot like judo or kali. You know, it's the cross with the X through it, eight angles, And at that point, then it becomes a 360 pattern.
Now,
I've never taught any of that, though. I've only taught the basic club swinging skills. I'm going to show some of the footwork at this clinic coming up.
Okay. Now, how many years total have you been doing Indian clubs?
I started when I was 8, so like 61 years, maybe.
Wow.
Hey, you'll get there one of these days, too. That might sound like a long time, but if you're 40, you're already there, Jack. I'm sorry.
Yeah. 30
it goes.
Yeah.
It's the blink of an eye, thank God.
Right. I'm telling you, it does go fast. Accelerates.
But no, and the thing about close swinging is you can do it all your life if you just don't burn the candle, you know, don't burn the damn candle out.
Right. Does weight matter with Indian clubs? I mean, is it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
The key is, think of it, think of the body. I'm going to put on the Asian mind flow. Think of the body as much as water as a rock. The body is water. We're 90% liquid. You know,
yeah.
we're like a bag of bile and phlegm, I think some of the Christian saints used to call it, a disgusting bag of bile and phlegm. A lot of liquid in there. So our movements have this propensity to be very liquid, very fluid. And so the idea, the weight has to open those little, the image would be of a petal, of a flower blossoming. You know, it has to open like that. It's almost, it's that subtle. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Fibers open in slow motion sometimes. So it's got to be that kind of, sometimes that gentle nudging is as important as saying, you know, open up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So yeah, starting with 1 pound is really good. You know, for some who are really frozen, you know, 2 pounds would be good. But the Olympic weight top, I think, was 3.
Really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing too is you don't want to lose speed. Now, but if you look carefully, you see some in Iran, Iraq, some are using. I've seen up to 100 pounds. I think the heaviest one I have here at home is probably 8 or 10 or 12, something like that.
Okay.
But those I can still swing very fast. I don't want to lose speed is why I was concerned about losing speed because I was doing, I had to teach martial arts.
Yeah.
I pretended to teach them, but I was doing them.
So is one of the goals to increase speed, or can you talk about the speed component of training with Indian clubs?
I think all our life,
yes,
we should be trying to maintain a speed that is effortless.
Yes,
the whole goal in life is what the Sikh call lightness. The goal in life would be to feel like you don't have a body,
right,
and simply be a force. And to be unaware that you have a body, but yet be fully aware of the movement itself.
Right.
Club swinging helps that because the movements are circular, so they are like one teacher would say, they are eternal. And there's another thing in Asia that they seem to really understand better than perhaps we in the West, is that if I can create in my body perfect circles, I have a better intuition of eternity. If I can begin to understand eternity, I will be able to live in the moment with less fear.
Huh.
And then the mechanist says, it's just something going on in your brain because it feels good to make the circles. Well, either way, it doesn't matter. You still feel the same way.
So this is something that Brett talked about in the recent interview, and he mentioned there were 5 basic movements. And this may be a little tough on a podcast, but can you describe the 5 moves?
Yeah, those guys, I don't really have a system. Like I was, I just swing. Those guys really put it together. Gray and Brett put it together, a really nice system. But if you can imagine, I think there's a way to say it. If you can imagine, if you're holding the club with a little ball around your little finger in the shaft, and you bring the arm straight up overhead, we'll just put the other arm, we'll just do one arm to make it easy, and put the other arm hand on your hip, and your feet are together, and you bring the arm straight up. As you bring the arm downward toward the outside, as it falls in a circle, and you drop the arm, there are these grip changes and turns that have to take place. And when you come to the front, then you have to be holding that with the wrist straight and the knuckles flat, and it's an inside block. And martial artists will recognize it. It's an inside block. So the inside block then follows with the elbow coming up across the center line. And as the elbow comes up, then the hand goes behind the head, and then the arm extends out and comes downward again. And this is a cycle. So in that cycle, virtually every muscle in the upper body is being employed in sequence, and there are hundreds of patterns. So basically, think of it as the alphabet of shoulder girdle movement. Imagine what happens to the shoulder girdle as we find these areas that never, ever get moved. I mean, they never go through that. It's a range they never go to, like a range combination of elbow, wrist, blah, blah, blah. They never get there. They don't even know where that is. and a lot of it's locked up. So the other thing about weight is that what you want to do is gently nudge it back open again. And also keep in mind, it's just one more tool in the toolbox.
Yes.
It's like it's a tool that does something very, very unique. Now, for the martial artists, of course, it's not only medical, it's also military. It's one of those, like swimming, that can be all three. It can also be a competition for beauty, so it's pedagogical, sport-based. So the club swinging, it's like a knife. The surgeon heals with it and the warrior kills with it.
Right.
It's all it is a knife. So it can be medical. It also has military implications because the patterns, martial movements, you'll see the slipping out of arm lock patterns, which is why, the Brits actually got it from the Indian warriors in the 1850s. And they were blown away with their prowess and how beautifully they moved, and they thought the clubs were part of that, and that's how it got back to Britain. But it's gone through so many different morphs that it doesn't look like club swinging is what happens. It's like the branch of a tree, like somebody creates their ambiance to it, or someone makes their own system. But that should be expected. They even got juggled when they came over. So when you see juggling pins, they began as bowling pins, but they weren't really juggled.
Right.
Yeah. Because the whole, remember, the purpose began as spiritual to begin with. The gods are using them for some metaphysical purpose. Then the warriors started using them for war. So, yeah, who knows where they're really from.
So you've worked with a lot of people teaching Indian clubs. I'm wondering, what are maybe some of the big anecdotal reports that people say they have benefits?
You know, I don't get many of those reports because I don't go out. I don't really pay much attention. But I can tell you over students over the years,
yes,
that I can say that students who have that I've had that have that's over like 40 years or so that I still hear from once in a while that they say it changed my life.
Right.
It's a life changer.
Yeah, and like you mentioned and Brett mentioned the same thing, it's something that is additive to a program, no matter what type of training you're already doing, and it doesn't take away. I actually asked Brett about, like, an Olympic weightlifter, for example. You know, would that be something? Would Indian clubs benefit an Olympic weightlifter? And
you know Tommy Kono? You ever heard
of
him?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
He uses my video.
Oh, wow.
I have a cheesy video on the market. I don't own the rights to any of it. I gave it all away. I'm embarrassed by it. It's such a bad video. But I, like I said, I didn't feel I was a teacher, and it sold on the market, and nice email from Tommy Kono, thank you.
Excellent.
But you know he would, because he's old enough to remember them, and I don't think he needed my video. My guess is that he had already done them before because he was fully familiar with them.
Right. Right.
Yeah. For it's sort of like saying, you know, med balls, are they any good? You know, where have they been?
Right.
How did we lose them? And so, in fact, there were four items that we see over and over again in the turn of the century system, and that was the weighted bar, we used to call the wand, and Indian clubs, medicine balls, and dumbbells. Those were the four horsemen. And you know the kettlebell probably would have been in it, but it was so uniquely Russian and that region of the world, so
right.
It didn't get here. You know, I think historians will put the kettlebell in. You know, when they look at your dead image, you know, like 50 years from now, then they'll see the kettlebell. Look at that old guy, huh?
Yeah,
in the kettlebell.
Oh man! Now you incorporate kettlebells into your training.
Yeah, like I said, it changes every. I usually change the training every December. Has been my tradition over the years.
Okay.
So every year, and a lot of times I don't train if I'm on some kind of a mission where I'm teaching a lot. I don't really. It's not for me. It's not the same as training.
Okay.
So training to me is a 24/7 event, like. And it's more. It's really not a. It's really more learning the movement stuff than it is work. In fact, I was mentioning to somebody a couple of years ago, I think that in my generation, I don't remember ever working out. I never worked out.
Right.
We always, even in wrestling, we never went in to work out. We were always skill development, but boy, it was hard work.
Yeah.
So I never went to any of these places to work out. I still do that the same way. You know, I still train the same way as it. I don't really work out at all.
Yeah. So you don't like that word workout. I actually...
Well, it's just that we never... It's more a way of thinking at how it works.
Absolutely.
You guys are changing that definition.
Right.
Because there's more instruction going on. So, and as you head toward that reality, the training takes on a different look. In fact, I think it was... Keeler, I forget what they're calling him now, but he's the father of Army physical fitness, and he mentions, along with others back then, that there's a certain level of fatigue you don't want to cross in your training. At that point, it's counterproductive, and that's where the technical quality wanes. And so you got to find that balance between technical quality and exertion, and we're still heading in that right direction, but they were a lot better at it in those older systems.
Right, right.
We're getting better. You know, it's really neat to watch all this evolving.
Now, Dr. Thomas, do you want to talk about the upcoming workshop that you and Brett Jones are doing this summer?
I don't really do these very often, and I told them all, Brett doesn't need me, and I'm not telling your listeners this just to make him feel good or to, you know, make you think this. It's not true, but no, you really got it. Because once you've done this for a while, you get it. Yeah. But I'm going to come out anyway and do it. I'm also going to introduce some of the harp stuff, I think, for those guys, because that's going to be the future.
Yeah.
And I think last year I introduced some training for the feet, which hadn't been seen before. And again, it goes back to my, you want to hear that one?
Oh, sure.
All right. So when I'm a little kid, see, back in the 1930s, they had podiatrists back then, but they were doctors, foot doctors. They also taught foot health and physical education. That was part of the PE curriculum, foot health. And one of the things they used, because they were ubiquitous back then, were marbles. And so they had marble exercises for the feet. They felt that the feet were like hands, and if you could make the feet move like hands, then the body would be much healthier. So by the time I was a little kid, that was still, marbles were still everywhere, and I must have seen older kids do it, but I began then to use marbles and projectiles. For me, it was a martial art. Marbles became a martial art. I learned how to throw them, picking them up with my feet, and using, which turns out to be kicking style, kicking movements, push kicks and snap kicks.
Right.
I just taught myself how to throw the marbles around. And so for foot health, it's absolutely amazing, because you're using your knee. It's like Indian clubs, you know, your hip and your knee and your ankle are all, then you have to release the marble, and it's a little teeny, you know, tactile little challenge down there. So I'm going to introduce, I call it Toe Olympics.
Yeah. Well,
I use balance beams and targets and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, what amazing training, because, I mean, your feet, I mean, which we have so many small intrinsic muscles in our foot that most people don't use, so that would be...
It is exhilarating.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, it's really fun to play against kids because they beat the crap out of you. Because they're good at it, you know?
That's funny.
They get it. I thought about putting something up on YouTube so the viewers can see, because it's so easy to do, but I begin with some basic movements on the ground where you sit in various postures and pick them up with the heel on the ground, off the ground, and then there's some rolling patterns where you pick it up, you roll it over your shoulder, drop it in the bucket. So it's a series of sequences. It's just not playing randomly with the marbles. And I worked on it. I think I put that together in the last year or so, too.
All right.
So, yeah, it's great fun. And when you get up on the balance beam, it's a whole different. Now you have to throw the marbles at the target while you're on the balance beam, which is pretty cool. And then you also use a bar across the back so you have no forward compromise of the shoulders. Everything has to come out of the hips.
Yeah.
And then I use a neck brace to elongate the neck to remind me to keep the chin up, so I'm not compromising the shoulders. So all the movement is coming from the right place. So it's a whole system of training to awaken the feet, but it's got a lot of nuance to it.
So when you say that you're training all the time, you really are training all the time, working on movement.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
I don't know what else. I don't know. I don't know what the hell else would be as interesting.
Right.
You know? But you see, the other thing is research. I'll give you an example. We'll go back to the harp for a second.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we know that the harp has something to do with not just with breathing, but with vibration. And that aligns with this renewed interest in vibration training and what that might have to be doing for the body. You know, I think, did that come out of Rush? I can't remember. But the vibration training, you know. Now you go to YouTube and look up solfeggio scales, and you're hopelessly down that bunny hole we talk about. Solfeggio scales are hertz frequencies that make what we call music, and it turns out that they might have some impact at the cellular level or at the tissue level. So, and these hertz frequencies now, some are, you know, YouTube is driving us crazy to try to figure out, you know, what is and what isn't useful. But when you start connecting the dots, you say, I'll at least give that a moment of attention.
Yeah.
Because I do understand now that vibration has an impact. Well, if that's true, then different hertz frequencies have different impacts.
Interesting.
And then you come to find out that a lot of the mantra that are used, and I, you know, once again, I'm way over my pay grade on this, out of my lane, so don't believe anything I'm about to tell you, all right? In fact, disregard about everything I told you. You should doubt it all, I promise you. I could be wrong, but when you look at some of the research on the mantra or some of the Gregorian chants and all, you know, all of that mind altering stuff, it turns out that these are aligned with some of these frequencies. So wow. Another way to put it is, if we were to rediscover ourselves in terms of physical training, there are three purposes that you get up in the morning every day and so you don't slit your wrist.
All right.
You do things for yourself because you want to avoid pain and feel comfortable. And then we do things for others. When we're kids, you know, we get nurtured into sharing something with somebody, and then teams and race and, you know, ethnic origin and family and all those other groups larger than ourselves, we begin to immerse ourselves in those needs. Well, Maslow said, you recognize this as Maslow's hierarchy.
Right.
Later in his life, he said, there's another dimension he called transcendence, which has something to do with some deeper meaning in life. And he said that also should be considered. He left that out of his early paradigm. Well, that's how you can look at the levels of physical training. In other words, when you get up and when I look in the mirror and see this body, and if I'm impressed with it, that could just be me. I could also look at it as an instrument of doing good for others, or also as some kind of a divine instrument. And whatever I see at that moment tells me where I am.
That's amazing. That's awesome insight.
Yeah, and that drives your training.
So right.
That should always drive, and it should also drive the training as you help others to understand why they're training. But if you look back at muscular Christianity, they weren't talking about doctrine or beliefs. It had nothing to do with that.
Okay.
It had to do simply with the body being a temple.
Right.
That's it. Not about anything other than that. That's pretty. That's something that is pretty easy to buy into when you think about it.
Absolutely.
Harder to hold on to, you know, in a crappy world. But
yeah.
You know, but it's a lot easier now with Whole Foods and all of these wonderful inventions out there and all these great. You know, this is amazing time.
So, Dr. Thomas, I'm going to attach a link in the show notes for this episode about the workshop. People can certainly go there for more information on that, and it sounds absolutely fantastic. I know you've mentioned a lot of books in the interview, but one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is there maybe one book that you'd recommend that all listeners definitely should put on their reading list?
You know, I hadn't thought about it. Yeah, I'll tell you one that would really be interesting to read would be... And it's pretty easy to get. It's through a used bookstore. It's called Markings, and it's by Dag Hammarskjöld. Dag Hammarskjöld was a secretary of the UN. He was killed in a plane crash, and it was published afterward. It's just his struggle to find meaning in life. Brilliant. You know, just little one pair. You know, the little one paragraph things.
Okay.
Amazing stuff. And you say, oh, well, you know what? I don't know how. You know, listen, I think that doesn't have too much to do with physical training. Once again, it has to do with why you're training, which is everything.
right.
The rest of it, you can, you know, they're monkey tricks.
Before my final question for you, is there any other thoughts or things that people should know about in regards to Indian clubs specifically, and maybe the benefits of Indian club training?
Yeah, I would say just start very gently with them, and don't expect too much. It's going to feel a lot like you're in a new neighborhood late for an appointment and lost.
It's going to feel,
because these highways inside the body, these synapses are misfiring. Your tongue will stick out, your toes will curl, you're sending messages all the wrong places at first, but that's okay. Another thing you think about is be aware of the compromises. Like when that arm is up holding the club, you'll see the wrist bending a lot in different angles because the shoulders are locked up. Just be aware of that and live with it and just keep nurturing it, and you'll feel pretty good later.
And I'm looking at your YouTube channel that you mentioned again, that I'll have a link for that in the show notes. But there are a couple, there's at least one video I see of club swinging at Fort Benning.
Yeah, that was the beginning of it all. I did some at Northern Illinois, but it really took off in the early 90s when I started using it with the military. I used to work for the Army Physical Fitness School. We incorporated it into the doctrine when I was there. So, yeah, that was a beautiful move, huh? Up on top of that building. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah. It's a really neat video.
Excellent.
And we did it because about 100 years earlier, soldiers had done that. So we decided to make a video.
All right. So, Dr. Thomas, my final question is the question I ask every interviewee is, what is your big advice or a specific action that you have for listeners after hearing this interview today?
Well, you know, once you doubt everything, that would be the first thing, is be doubtful. And then, but, you know, go back and maybe listen to it a couple times and think about it.
This has been really, really fantastic. I know that I took a lot of notes. I certainly learned a lot, as I always do. A whirlwind of information. And I'm looking forward to listening through to this interview again, as I always do. And so thank you so much. Again, I know that you don't always do these interviews. So it's really, really such a privilege to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Well, glad to do it. And good luck to all of you out there. You're doing God's work, and you know, fight hard, okay?
Thank you. All right, guys, I'm going to wrap up this episode here real quick. Again, a huge thanks to Dr. Thomas for doing the interview. I know that he does not do interviews very often at all, and I'm very grateful and honored that he came on the Ardella Training Podcast to share his great insight and knowledge, and I hope that you got value from it. Again, definitely very innovative topics and insights than we've ever discussed here on the podcast. So I hope that you enjoyed it. So with that, guys, I'm going to sign off. Make sure that if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for the show, definitely connect with me through the ardellatraining.com website, or catch me on Facebook, the fan page, facebook.com/ardellatraining, or catch me on Instagram at ardellatraining. I'd love to hear from you and connect with you there as well. Thanks so much for being with me this week, and I'll see you soon on the Ardella Training Podcast. That's it. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Ardella Training Podcast. Go to ardellatraining.com right now to join Scott's tribe of passionate fitness enthusiasts. Get valuable updates and resources that will help you take it to the next level. Train strong. We'll catch you next time on the Ardella Training Podcast.